This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel. The three House panels leading the impeachment probe want President Trump's top White House aide to testify this week. AP's Washington correspondent Sagar Meghani reports from the White House.
Gordon Sondland says his memory was refreshed by statements from two other key witnesses. He says he now remembers telling a top aide to Ukraine's president in September that military aid would likely not flow to Ukraine until it made a public statement about fighting corruption. President Trump had earlier linked the aid to investigating Joe Biden and Democrats. Sondland says when he asked during a September phone call about holding up the aid, the president nearly hung up on him, but then told him, "I want nothing. I want no quid pro quo." The impeachment panels released transcripts today of the testimony Sondland and former Ukraine special envoy Kurt Volker gave last month. Sagar Meghani at the White House.
U.S. President Donald Trump says it's time for Mexico and the United States to join forces and wage war against drug cartels after the deaths of nine U.S. citizens ambushed while traveling in a convoy in Mexico near the U.S. border. The U.S. leader is calling for a crackdown on armed drug groups south of the border following the ambush on an American family residing in Mexico. Three women and at least six children died in the brutal attack. Mexican President Andre Manuel Lopez Obrador said Tuesday that Trump's suggestion of joint military action is not in agreement with his government's convictions. He said the worst thing is war. The top general for U.S. military operations in Africa visited Somalia Tuesday to meet with leaders and discussions the fight against extremists in the Horn of Africa nation. U.S. Army General Stephen Townsend said he would assess the progress of the U.S. military campaign against the Islamic State and the local al-Qaeda affiliate al-Shabaab. He called them a threat to African partners, to U.S. interests in East Africa, and to the U.S. homeland. Lebanese troops deployed Tuesday throughout the country to reopen roads and main thoroughfares closed by anti-government protesters. For VOA, Dale Gavlik reports from Beirut.
Even at the best of times, Beirut's traffic-clogged streets can send tempers flaring. But add another element to the mix, such as roadblocks protesters are using to pressure authorities to meet their demands, and you have daily life turned upside down, says Helena Keenan, a Beirut resident and mother of three.
The roadblocks have been one of the main barriers to getting the schools reopened. It seemed that at about 5 or 6 p.m., schools will announce that schools open the next day, and then there'll be a barrage of various Twitter and Facebook posts saying, "We need to get to the streets, we need to close roads, we need to protest."
The protesters have demanded an end to traditional sectarian politics and for independent members to form a new government. Dale Gavlik for VOA News, Beirut.
The Journal of the American Medical Association says that one in four American high schoolers and one in 10 children in middle school have used an e-cigarette in the past 30 days. The journal published two separate studies of the impact of vaping on American youth. The study says efforts by state and federal officials to discourage underage vaping are falling short. Those efforts include a ban on sale of e-cigarettes to anyone younger than 18 and a ban on most flavored vaping products. Government health officials are estimating that millions of cases of heart disease and other illnesses can be traced back to childhood abuse or trauma. AP's Jackie Quinn reports.
Researchers have been studying for decades how suffering or witnessing traumatic events as a child can affect the likelihood of physical injury or illness later in life. They know that stressful experiences like violence, divorce, or mental illness in the home can affect how a child's body develops and start a path towards smoking, drug use, and other unhealthy behaviors. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says intervention could potentially reduce the number of adults with weight problems by 2%, the number with coronary heart disease by 13%, and depression by 44%. The findings are based on questionnaires from 144,000 Americans. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is heading to Germany on Wednesday to mark the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. He is attending to underscore what U.S. officials say is the need to continue a strengthened transatlantic partnership. For more news, please go to voanews.com. I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Face-to-face talks in Kampala between South Sudan's two main rival leaders have adjourned until Thursday.
They should sacrifice their personal interests at the altar of broader national interests so that they can give actually chance their people to go back and rebuild South Sudan.
Charles Chisa is a professor of international relations at Kampala International University. Ugandan opposition politician Chisa Besigye recounts this week's alleged police attack on him. Emergency relief is pouring into food-stricken Somalia, and a man claiming to be the cousin of Liberian President George Weah is alleging corruption in the Liberian government.
A friend of mine came to me in Mali. They asked me they wanted to go to Liberia to invest into the real estate market. They wanted to build 50,000 homes, which worth close to $1 billion. But to my surprise, they went behind me trying to extort money from the people.
Augustine Weah says he is a cousin of President George Weah of Liberia, but the Liberian government says Augustine Weah himself is facing corruption charges before the courts of Liberia and the influence of Stokely Carmichael's political activities in Africa. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Face-to-face talks in Uganda's capital, Kampala, between South Sudan President Salva Kiir and his main rival, Riek Machar, have adjourned until Thursday at the request of Ugandan authorities. The two are expected to discuss unresolved issues ahead of a looming November 12 deadline to form a national unity government. Some analysts say Kiir and Machar should seize the opportunity to agree on forming a transitional government so that peace can finally return to South Sudan. Mugumi Davis-Riker reports from Kampala.
Charles Chisa, a professor of international relations and diplomacy at Kampala International University, says South Sudanese, both in and outside the country, deserve peace.
It's not about them. It's about, you know, like the South Sudanese people that have suffered for so long. We have so many here in Uganda and they are languishing in camps. The conditions are not so good and I believe they would want to really return home. And so they should sacrifice their personal interests at the altar of broader national interests so that they can give actually chance their people to go back and rebuild South Sudan.
According to the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, more than 5 million people in South Sudan have been forced free from their homes, half of these into refugee in neighboring countries. The talks between South Sudan rivals are centered on ramping up the process for screening and reunifying forces to create a united national army before Machar returns in the country to serve for a second time as South Sudan's first vice president. Chisa says security is key ahead of the formation of a new government.
My prayer is that the president, Salva Kiir, should appreciate the fact that Machar has got serious concerns of security and really ensure him that actually he's going to be secure when he comes to participate in the government of national unity. Once he feels that he's not secure, I don't think he's really going to come to South Sudan. And if he doesn't come, then it means, you know, like peace is going to be in the balance.
The issues at hand remain the creation of the cantonment areas, the screening of the entire VIP protection force, and the unification of government and rebel forces by November. Chisa says he's optimistic the two leaders who previously worked together can agree to form the intergovernment ahead of the deadline. Retired Ambassador Harold Achema agrees.
You know, remember at one time, Dr. Machar was in South Africa, was not even in the region here. So I think there's hope. I'm optimistic that, some positive development will take place. I think there's goodwill on both sides. And certainly with the backing of the neighboring countries, I think the two leaders, you see, really for the sake of the country and for the sake of the region, they really have to put aside their differences.
Both Chisa and Achema say peace in South Sudan are vital for socioeconomic development as well as stability of the region. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Longtime Ugandan opposition leader Chisa Besigye says police launched a deliberate attack on him on Monday as he tried to attend an opposition function. But police say their use of force was reasonable because Dr. Besigye was engaged in an unlawful assembly. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Kizza Besigye, a four-time challenger to President Yoweri Museveni, described his alleged attack Monday by police as uncalled for and premeditated. Besigye says he was heading for the anniversary gathering of the Opposition Forum for Democratic Change Party when he was surrounded by police officers. The FDC meeting was initially scheduled to be held at the Mandela National Stadium, but was moved when the stadium was allegedly sealed off by police. Vestia said while he was heading to the other venue, police started firing tear gas and blockaded the road with trucks.
I was facing in front, this water cannon truck was behind, and all of a sudden, you know, it was like I was hit by some kind of block or something heavy. Boom! So as soon as I was hit, I was thrown over the front of the car. I was only lucky that the people who were in the car were very quick to react and grabbed my legs. Otherwise, I would have gone all over to the ground.
Vestia says he only sustained soft tissue injuries and climbed back into his car to continue on to the event. But as he and his party made their way into town, he says police again stopped them and started hitting the car. Officers then allegedly used a gun muzzle to break into the car and fired pepper spray at Besigye and his colleagues. Besigye and two other people who were in the car now face a charge of holding an illegal assembly. Patrick Onyango, the Kampala Metropolitan Police spokesperson, tells VOA that Besigye was also blocking traffic.
We carefully opened the door with reasonable force and we removed him from the car. Because he had blocked the road, he had inconvenienced other road users. That is a highway where there is a lot of traffic.
Besigye said he will continue to fight for people's rights and against Museveni, who has ruled Uganda for 33 years.
Our struggle is to break out of captivity. The attack that is made on leaders is not primarily actually intended for the leaders. The more serious intention on their part is to terrorize those who see us as their leaders.
Police have harassed Besigye and blocked his movements around Kampala for years. Besigye, who now leads the People's Government Movement, has not said whether he'll make another run against Museveni in the 2021 election. His treatment Monday will likely raise concern among rights activists who suspect the government will disrupt opposition gatherings as Museveni tries to win another term. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
Today's Wednesday, November 6th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 13 minutes past the hour. In Liberia, a man claiming to be the cousin of Liberian President George Mani Weah is alleging corruption involving the Minister of State for Presidential Affairs, Nathaniel McGill, and the former managing director of Liberia's National Housing Authority, Doana Soyan. Augustin Weah says he took officials of a Burkina Faso-based company to Liberia in 2018 to invest in the construction of 50,000 low-cost housing units. But to his surprise, Weah says the managing director of the housing authority demanded a bribe of $80,000 before an MOU could be signed. Weah also alleges that the Minister of State for Presidential Affairs also demanded a $500,000 bribe. Augustin Weah says he complained to his cousin, the Liberian President George Weah, but to his surprise, the president took no action.
A friend of mine came to me in Mali, where I was stationed with the United Nations office. They asked me, they wanted to go to Liberia to invest into the real estate market. And I was impressed because I knew that I wanted to create jobs for our people. They wanted to build 50,000 homes, which worth close to $1 billion. But then when we went to Liberia, we have the first meeting with the government official concerned, the Minister of State for Presidential Affairs, Mr. Nathaniel McGill, and I informed the President of the Republic of Liberia of my arrival to Liberia with my team. And we had an MOU signed, and we met the managing director for the National Housing Authority, Mr. Doana Soyan. But to my surprise, they went behind him trying to extort money from the people. The president of the company has sent his emissary to give them $80,000. And when I got to know about that, I got very upset. And I confronted them, and I said, if this does not exist, I'm going to have the President of the Republic informed. And I did inform the President of the Republic, who was George Mani Weah, who happened to be a cousin of mine. But unfortunately for me, there was no action taken. Then the Minister of State for Presidential Affairs, Mr. Matane Mangil, again requested $500,000 from the investor, my partner. So I presented all my documents to the President of the Republic of Liberia. Again, the President did not take no action.
Mr. Weah, you mentioned the Minister of State for Presidential Affairs, Mr. Nathaniel McGill. So how much money altogether did you allege that he tried to extort from your company?
The first one that was given to him was $80,000, and they requested additional $500,000 in order for them to sign the contract with the Burkinabes. But again, I told the President of the Republic of Liberia that this is not going to happen, and I will have to speak out. Later, Nathaniel McGill again told my company to change the company name. He went back to the investor, and the company name was changed to SS International. He brought them back to Liberia, and I was excluded from the company. And now they are currently in Liberia doing the construction work that they came to do.
You mentioned you were the second shareholder in this GPAT company. When the company went back to Liberia to reestablish, did the company exclude you, or did the Liberian government do that?
The company told me that they were instructed by the Liberian government and meaning the Minister of State and his people that I should be excluded in order for them to sign the deal with them with a new name. And the partner reached out to me that they have spent a lot of money with the Liberian government already. So they have no choice but to proceed with the deal. And so they went ahead and removed me from the new contract that they signed with Access International.
As you mentioned, the president, the government is trying to attract investors. If what you are saying is true, what lessons do you think people should draw from this?
Mr. Bote, thanks for asking this question, because I just want to warn our people to be very careful. You know, it's just sad that we have to reach a point that we have to defend ourselves, because I have left my work. I have volunteered my service to my country of birth, Liberia, just to help create jobs for my people. I'm a patriot. I just came to help. But I just want people to draw a conclusion to this, that you invest in Liberia, you just have to be careful and mindful who you deal with.
Mr. Weah, thank you very much again.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Augustine Weah is a man who claims he is a cousin of Liberian President George Weah. He was speaking with us from Charlotte, North Carolina. Liberia's Minister of Information, Eugene Nambe, says Augustine Weah, the man claiming to be the cousin of President George Weah, is not related to the president. Augustine Weah says he took officials of a Burkina Faso-based company to Liberia in 2018 to invest in the construction of 50,000 low-cost housing units. But to his surprise, the managing director of the Liberian Housing Authority demanded a bribe of $80,000 before an MOU could be signed. Weah also alleges that the Minister of State for Presidential Affairs, Nathaniel McGill, also demanded a $500,000 bribe. But Information Minister Eugene Nambuye says Augustine Weah himself is facing corruption charges in the courts of Liberia.
I'm aware that there is a judicial matter ongoing before the court in Liberia, where Mr. Weah has been indicted by the prosecution in Liberia, along with other co-defendants, are undergoing court trial. If he has made specific allegations against the government, I'm not aware of those.
Minister, Mr. Weah said that he brought a company to Liberia to construct an estimated 50,000 housing units for the people of Liberia. And in the process, the Minister of State for Presidential Affairs, Mr. Nathaniel McGee, requested for kickbacks in order for this company to take roots. What do you know about that?
Based on the evidence that's been made available to the court, all of these allegations against both Minister McGill and other members of the government have not been proven to be true, you know. In fact, because of the total lack of any evidence against the minister, you know, the matter is before the court of Liberia. We, as a government, once the allegations were made public, the president dismissed two officials of government, that is the former managing director of the National Housing Authority, Mr. Blana Sayan, and also his deputy. They are currently before the courts of Liberia. And I will urge Mr. Weah to also submit himself to the court process, because there is an ongoing judicial process where those who have been accused, including the former managing director, have submitted himself to the court and he's testified, he's made his presentation to the court. So how is it now that the one who has been accused is now the one who is making most accusations and he's targeting other portions in the hierarchy of government, including Mr. McGill.
Mr. Augustine Weah is alleging that twice he made a report or a complaint to President George Weah about the Minister of State for Presidential Affairs, Mr. McGee. And he said on both occasions, President Weah did not take action.
But Mr. President did take action when we noticed that there were accusations. Now, if the person who spoke to Mr. Weah had allegations against Mr. McGee, there is a platform for him to abuse. You know, there is a court case that's ongoing that Mr. Augustine Weah is a party to. You know, look, there is a whole lot of complication. You know, if Augustine Weah bears a similar name with the president, you know, he has been going around presenting himself as a relative of the president, which I know that is not true. He has used this similarity of name to extort money from people, and he has been asked to submit himself to the judicial process. You know, he's not related to Mr. President. Or he tells people that the president is his cousin. How? You know, it's all been done so that because he has a similar name with the president, you know, he can utilize that to accept money from people. You know, I wanted to check this as a journalist, you know, as a purveyor of the truth.
Minister Nambwe, always nice to talk with you.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Eugene Nambwe is Liberia's information minister. He was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. Emergency assistance is starting to pour into Somalia, where hundreds of thousands have been driven from their homes by severe flooding. Lisa Schlein has the latest from Geneva.
More than 300,000 people have been made homeless by some of the worst flooding experienced by Somalia in years. Parts of the country, especially in the central Somali district of Beledweyne, have been devastated. Aid agencies are responding with increasing speed. For example, the World Food Program has distributed ready-to-eat food and high-energy biscuits to thousands of the displaced. The UN Migration Agency has delivered more than 3,200 non-food supply kits containing blankets, mattresses, and kitchen sets. The UN Refugee Agency this week delivered humanitarian supplies in the first of a series of flights organized to help more than 20,000 people cut off by the flooding. UNHCR spokesman Andre Mahecic says up to 10 flights, three a day, are scheduled to airlift 60 metric tons of supplies.
The air operation largely depends on landing strips being available as floodwaters have engulfed a vast area. Reports of our partners indicate that villages on the outskirts of Beledweyne, which is about 340 kilometers north of capital Mogadishu, have been submerged and hundreds of families are trapped in their homes.
In the meantime, the World Health Organization warns many flood-hit districts have become cholera hotspots, with few healthcare facilities available to treat the sick. It says there also has been an upsurge of malaria and diarrhea. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich tells VOA the floods give rise to other health issues.
One of them is obviously it's injuries. People get injured. There's a risk of drowning. There is a risk of being cut just walking through the water, stepping on nails or on glass. And then there is also issue of access to health services because the health facilities become difficult to reach.
UN officials warn disasters such as the Somali floods highlight the increasing vulnerabilities of people in this country and others to the effects of global warming and climate change. They note this latest calamity was preceded by a severe drought in July. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
At a recent conference on leftist revolutionary thought in Africa during the 60s and 70s, writer and journalist Amadla Thomas Johnson gave a thought-provoking speech on the influence of Stokely Carmichael's political activities in Africa. Carmichael, who was born in Trinidad and Tobago, was a prominent civil rights activist in the United States before eventually moving to Conakry, Guinea, where he became a pan-African leader. Thomas Johnson spoke with Ricky Shryak about the history of Carmichael and how his activist efforts echo today on the continent of Africa.
Stokely is a really interesting person because he seems to connect different aspects of, you could say, the sort of global movements that are to do with people of African descent. He's born in Trinidad and Tobago, which is in the Caribbean. He then moves to the United States and gets involved in the civil rights movement until he then sort of proclaims Black Power, this sort of radical sort of proclamation for Black self-determination. and he gives rise to the sort of black militant movement, which, you know, the sort of Black Panthers sort of come from as well. And then he goes to Guinea, where he spends a lot of time with Kwame Nkrumah and sort of becomes a Pan-Africanist. So he really does, you know, sort of connect the African continent to the African diaspora in a way that few people really can at that point. He then lives for another 30 years in Guinea on the African continent, and he gets to meet many sort of revolutionaries. I think his big contribution really is to sort of enlarge our understanding of Pan-Africanism to include people of the African diaspora living in the Caribbean, living in the United States, and living also in South America and in Europe as well.
He was a leader of the All African People's Revolutionary Party. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
The party was sort of established in 1968 in Guinea, and the founders were Kwame Nkrumah and Stokely Carmichael, who, by the way, would, you know, take on the name Kwame Ture in honor of Kwame Nkrumah and Sekou Touré, his, you know, President Sekou Touré, his host in Guinea. What really happens is Nkrumah is quite intent on having this party sort of spread throughout Africa. Nkrumah, by this point, had been deposed as president of Ghana. And now in exile in Conakry, he would be looking across the continent and sort of seeing that there was sort of counter coup after counter coup against the sort of independence movements. And so his idea really was that there needs to be a party to unite all of the different revolutionary parties together so that we can try and push for a sort of, you know, Pan-African unity.
Is the organization active today at all?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, the party is still active today, actually, and it still has a presence in Africa. By the way, it has a presence in Senegal, has a presence in Kenya, in South Africa. So it's still around. It has a presence on the continent, and has a presence in Europe, has a presence in America, and in the Caribbean, I believe, as well. So the party is still active. I think the remarkable thing about Stokely is that actually, you know, of all the civil rights leaders, he was actually quite young. He was born in 1941. And so he sort of spans the sort of civil rights period through the sort of African independence period, you know, to the late 1990s. So, you know, many of the people involved in the party today would have met him, you know, even if they're sort of in their 40s or their 50s, they would have met him and learned from him. So he really was able to sort of carry that on, you know, until his last.
Amadla Thomas Johnson is a writer and journalist. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar, Senegal. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Somalia's Al-Shabaab militants have released a video that for the first time gives a partial view of the group's leader, Abu Abidar. The video, released on Tuesday, shows Abidar meeting with Shabaab fighters in a forest before the group failed September 30 raid on Biledoga, an airbase used by U.S. forces in Somalia. The video shows Abidar's hands and shoulders, but blurs out his face. His voice is heard addressing the would-be attackers, telling them to target U.S. military personnel in the attack. Face-to-face talks in Uganda's capital, Kampala, between South Sudan President Salva Kiir and his main rival, Riek Machar, have adjourned until Thursday at the request of Ugandan authorities. The two are expected to discuss unresolved issues ahead of a looming November 12th deadline to form a national unity government. Some analysts say Kiir and Machar should seize the opportunity to agree on forming a transitional government so that peace can finally return to South Sudan. And in Liberia, a man claiming to be the cousin of Liberian President George Mani Weah is alleging corruption involving the Minister of State for Presidential Affairs, Nathaniel McGee, and the former Managing Director of Liberia's National Housing Authority, Duana Suryan. And that's it for this Wednesday, November 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barty, wishing you a very good day.
Hi, I'm Larry London. Don't miss your chance to get the Now 71 CD, including some of the top hit songs of today's biggest stars.
I can't write one song that's not about you. Can't drink without you.
The CD features Billie Eilish as Bad Guy.
So you're a tough guy, like you're really rough guy. Just can't get enough guy, just always so puff guy. I'm that bad type, make your mama sad type. Make your girlfriend mad type.
Lil Nas X, Old Town Road.
Yeah, I'm gonna take my horse to the Old Town Road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more. I'm gonna take my horse to the Old Town Road. I'm gonna ride.
And many of the greatest hits. You can only get the chance to win by listening to Border Crossings. Tune us in every day at 1500 UTC.